Picture this. Tom is a 35-year-old man seeing you for an annual physical exam required by his job. Tom is generally in good health, but he smells of alcohol, and it's only 4 p.m. You ask Tom how much he drinks, and he readily shares that he has been drinking since college, just like all of his friends, but just a beer or two at night, and it's no big deal. You pause, thinking of the best approach to Tom's alcohol use and how to gauge his insight into his own behavior. Welcome to Audio Bricks. I'm Laurel Toft, bringing psychiatry from our bricks to your ears. After completing this section, you will be able to 1. Explain the essential features of substance use disorders. 2. Describe the epidemiology of substance use disorders. 3. Explain how the reward pathway in the brain is involved in the development of substance use disorders, and describe how the brain changes during active use and recovery. And 4. Describe the evidence-based assessments and treatment approaches for substance use disorders. Part 1. What defines a substance use disorder? Substance use disorder, or SUD, refers to a pattern of substance use, be it nicotine, cannabis, cocaine, opioids, or something else, that causes significant impairment or distress to the user. SUD is prevalent and growing in the United States and around the world. People of any age may be at risk for developing SUD, but exposure to and experimentation with alcohol and drugs usually begins in adolescence. Substance abuse has been recognized as a mental health disorder for many years. But instead of separating substance use from abuse, we now use the term substance use disorder, SUD, with specifiers to describe the severity of the use. As with all types of substance abuse, a person needs to exhibit 2 of the 11 diagnostic criteria over a 12-month period of time to fulfill the definition of SUD. The criteria can be separated into physiologic, psychologic, and psychosocial categories. 3 of the criteria are obvious physiological signs that most people associate with addiction, including cravings, or feeling a strong desire or urge to use a substance, tolerance, which is requiring more of the substance to acquire the same effects, and withdrawal, which is relieved by taking more of the substance. 3 of the criteria involve psychological lack of control over substance use, and these are often taking larger amounts or using the substance for a longer time than intended, a persistent desire or unsuccessful attempts to cut down or control substance use, and continuing to use the substance despite knowing that a persistent physical or psychological problem is probably caused or made worse by the substance. And lastly, 5 criteria outline the negative social impacts of substance use. Recurrent use of the substance in situations where it is physically hazardous. Spending a lot of time obtaining, using, or recovering from substance use. Failing to meet important obligations at work, school, or home because of recurrent substance use. Continuing to use the substance despite recurrent social or interpersonal problems caused or made worse by its use. And finally, giving up or reducing important social, occupational, or recreational activities because of substance use. Severity is then determined by the total number of criteria met. If a person meets 6 or more criteria, that's considered severe SUD, whereas only meeting 2 or 3 of the criteria is considered mild. On the flip side, when a person no longer exhibits any criteria of SUD, they are in remission. Early remission lasts between 3 and 12 months of not meeting the criteria, and sustained remission is reached when the person meets no criteria for 12 months or longer. Remission in a controlled environment can be achieved when someone with SUD is in a restricted setting without access to the substance, a sort of forced remission. Time for a knowledge check. Question: what is the duration that must be met to qualify for a sustained remission from a substance use disorder? Answer is, sustained remission is when no criteria is met for 12 months or longer. Now, I know you're probably familiar with many of the substances involved in SUD, especially with the opioid epidemic that has ravaged the U.S. But it's a long list, so to help you keep things straight, you can mentally organize these substances into a few categories. First, central nervous system depressants like alcohol, opioids, think fentanyl and heroin, and some overlapping group of drugs called the sedatives, hypnotics, anxiolytics. The most famous in this hodgepodge group are the benzodiazepines like Valium. Next, CNS stimulants, which include amphetamines like crystal meth and cocaine, but also the more common substances caffeine and nicotine, which is the psychoactive agent in tobacco products. And finally, there's a few that don't fit into either category, which include cannabis, hallucinogens, and inhalants. Many of these substances impair or alter the user's behavior and experiences. I mean, this is often why the user is taking the substance in the first place. These drugs act on the brain to cause impaired control and perception along with disinhibition, which can lead to risk-taking behavior. The pharmacological action of these drugs can lead to tolerance and withdrawal, which also help drive some of the psychosocial behaviors. There are common stigmas related to substance use disorders, particularly in the United States. You may have heard or even thought some of these myths, like drug use is a personal choice related to willpower, or people simply choose not to stop using and do not need help, or drug use is only a problem for homeless or unemployed people. Or lastly, people use drugs to escape or cope with personal problems. But SUD is a recognized mental illness. There is a physical dependence on the substance being used, and it is extremely difficult to quit, even when the user desires to. Success rates for quitting increase substantially when a user seeks help. And although social factors play a role in developing SUD, anyone can start using and become addicted to drugs, not just homeless or unemployed people. Knowledge check-in time. True or false? Drug use is a personal choice and users choose not to quit. Answer is false, of course. Part 2. How common are substance use disorders? In the United States today, about 8% of people 12 years and older have a substance use disorder. Most of this 8% have an alcohol use disorder, about 6%. A smaller portion are illicit drug users, 3%, with a small overlapping group using both, or 1%. Most adolescents try alcohol, 80% of them, and 50% of adolescents experiment with drugs. The younger the age at which use begins, the higher the risk that the drug or alcohol use will persist and develop into a use disorder. In fact, this is the strongest predictor of long-term use. SUD is highly heritable. A first-degree family member with addiction is another of the strongest predictors of developing the disorder. Other common risk factors include family dysfunction, negative life events, low self-esteem, and poor social connections. Most people with SUD have several of these risk factors. Protective factors include strong connections to social clubs, sports, and higher education. Here's your knowledge check-in. What is the strongest risk factor to predict future or continued substance use? Answer: age at first use predicts a higher risk of continued substance use. Part 3. How does a substance use disorder affect the brain and behavior? A famous 1980s drug-free American ad campaign put it like this. The host showed an egg saying, "This is your brain," and a hot frying pan saying, "This is drugs." He then cracked the egg into the sizzling hot pan and said, "This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?" And while that's probably not enough detail for a physician, they had it right that drugs alter brain function. The main area of the brain involved in SUD is the mesocortical limbic system, also known as the reward pathway. This pathway includes three areas: the nucleus accumbens, the ventral tegmental area, and the frontal cortex. The connections between these three areas are stimulated by pleasurable activities. Drug use triggers release of dopamine in the mesocortical limbic system, which strengthens the connections and motivates the person to continue the activity stimulating this pathway. People use a substance frequently because it provides intense feelings of euphoria and joy. These feelings strengthen the release of dopamine in the mesocortical limbic system and reinforce the activity that causes these feelings. The caveat here is that these feelings are attenuated over time. People frequently have to use more of a substance to achieve the same effects. Eventually, substance use users are unable to attain the positive effects that they seek. Studies have demonstrated many different changes in the brains of those with SUD versus those without. For example, those who use methamphetamines have reduced gray matter volume on MRI studies compared with non-users, and the same can be seen in people with chronic alcohol use disorder. Functional imaging studies have even shown decreased activity in the frontal cortex in those who use alcohol and drugs versus those who do not have SUD. Children and adolescents do not have fully developed brains and are especially susceptible to the negative impact and consequences of substance use. The frontal cortex, which deals with abstract thought, impulse control, and risk assessment, is very sensitive to dopamine release, which means that substances may be even more pleasurable for developing brains. The young brain's extra sensitivity to dopamine release and its pleasurable effects helps explain why a younger age at first substance contact results in one of the highest risks for continued use. Continued substance use results in the depletion of dopamine stores, desensitization of dopamine receptors, and a new state of homeostasis. This is when symptoms of withdrawal begin to appear when the person is not using. Withdrawal symptoms depend on the substance, but they can include headaches, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, tremors, restlessness, insomnia, hyperphagia, seizures, and hallucinations. Substance use is extremely difficult to change. Besides being euphoric, the brain and body develop a physical dependence on the substance, making withdrawal very uncomfortable, to put it mildly. Even those who want to stop their drug use often cannot bear the feelings of withdrawal and seek the drug out to feel normal again. Take alcohol, for example. It is imperative to assess patients for alcohol use when they are admitted to the hospital because alcohol withdrawal is dangerous and potentially fatal. A person can begin experiencing the symptoms of alcohol withdrawal as quickly as a few hours, resulting in high blood pressure, hallucinations, and even seizures. Many psychological, environmental, and physiological factors can trigger substance use, and they differ for each person. For one person, a trigger might be mood change like depression, and for others, the trigger might be withdrawal symptoms. Time for another knowledge check. What brain changes noted on MRI are seen in people who use methamphetamines or people with chronic alcohol use disorder? Answer is, MRI scans of people who use meth or are chronic alcohol users show reduced gray matter volume. Part 4. What tools are available for assessment of substance use disorders? Evidence-based resources are available to help screen for substance-related disorders, and most of them take less time to administer than listening to this audio brick. The tools come in all shapes and sizes. Some screening tools apply to any substance, including the Screening to Brief Intervention, S2BI, or the Tobacco Alcohol Prescription Medication and Other Substance Use Tool, TAPS. Others are specific to one substance, for example, the Alcohol Use Disorder Identification Test, AUDIT, or the classic CAGE, C-A-G-E questionnaire for alcohol, or the Opioid Risk Tool, the ORT. Notably, some of the screening tools were developed specifically for adolescents and others are geared more towards adults. Part 5. How are substance use disorders treated? Treatment for SUD has two main prongs, pharmacologic and psychosocial therapies. Evidence suggests that psychosocial interventions are the most effective. Specific pharmacological treatment is available for certain but not all substances with varying effects, such as antabuse or disulfiram, which makes patients feel ill if they drink alcohol, or varenicline to decrease tobacco cravings. SUD is complex and different for each individual, so the therapy should be tailored to each individual as well. It is helpful to have a multidisciplinary treatment approach that includes general practitioners, psychiatrists, social workers, and community programs. The Stages of Change model is a widely accepted trans-theoretical model of behavior change that is often used in the field of addiction. You're probably familiar with the stages of change from the common vernacular. So let's walk through some of the stages with a fictional patient, Mike. Mike has been smoking cigarettes since he was a teenager and currently smokes 1.5 packs per day. In the pre-contemplation stage, Mike has no intention of stopping smoking and does not believe that his cigarette smoking is a problem. My grandmother smoked every day of her life and died at age 99 of old age, he always says. But when Mike's father gets diagnosed with lung cancer, he starts to think that smoking might have some consequences and starts to consider quitting. We call this stage contemplation. At Thanksgiving that year, Mike announces to his family that he's going to quit smoking for a New Year's resolution, and his entire family decides to do this together. They are in the preparation stage, preparing to quit usually within the next 30 or so days. Once January 1st rolls around, Mike begins the action stage by cutting back his cigarette use by half every week. It takes him several months, but with the help of nicotine gum and a prescription for varenicline, Mike stops cigarettes completely. He then enters the maintenance and relapse prevention stage, trying to sustain his new cigarette-free lifestyle. Part 6. Substance-specific treatments. Let's discuss two examples of substance-specific treatments that are well established. The well-known Alcoholics Anonymous began as a way to promote sobriety in people with alcoholism, but has evolved into a program for addiction rehabilitation in general. To this day, it remains one of the most effective systems for achieving long-term sobriety. There are 12 steps in this program, and you've probably heard several of them. Step 1 is, quote, admitting we were powerless over alcohol or other drug and that our lives have become unmanageable. Perhaps the best known step is, quote, made a list of all persons we have harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Now let's turn to tobacco, specifically smoking. Permanently giving up smoking is incredibly difficult, perhaps the most difficult of all addictive substances. Mark Twain said, giving up smoking is easy. I've done it hundreds of times. It takes an average of 8 to 11 attempts to quit, and for some people as many as 30 attempts. Smoking has a major impact on mortality, but physician involvement increases the chances that a person will quit smoking. The first step as a physician is simply asking if they are ready to quit. And for those who are ready, nicotine replacement therapy is the first-line pharmacologic therapy, with options such as gum or a nicotine patch. Other effective pharmacologic therapies include varenicline, a partial nicotinic receptor blocker, and the antidepressant bupropion. Last knowledge check. What is the first-line pharmacotherapy for nicotine cessation? For those ready to stop smoking, nicotine replacement therapy is the first-line pharmacologic therapy. And that's it today for substance use disorders. Let's check your knowledge and see what you've learned. First, what are the essential diagnostic features of SUD? SUD is a pattern of substance use that causes impairment or distress to the user. Diagnostic features are in three categories: physiologic, psychologic, and psychosocial. At least two criteria must be met in the past 12 months to diagnose SUD. Next, can you describe the epidemiology of SUD? About 8% of people 12 years and older in the U.S. have a diagnosable SUD. Age at first substance use is the highest predictor of future substance use. Now, can you explain how the reward pathway in the brain is involved in the development of SUD? The main area of the brain involved in substance use disorder is known as the reward pathway, or the mesocortico-limbic system, which mainly uses the neurotransmitter dopamine. Adolescents are especially susceptible to the pleasurable effects of substance because of their developing brain. And last, can you describe the evidence-based treatment approaches for SUD? Treatment options are both psychosocial and pharmacologic and should be individually tailored to the person. Alcoholics Anonymous continues to be one of the most effective alcohol cessation therapies available. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge of substance use disorder, let's revisit our patient from earlier in the episode to see how best to approach his substance use. Thinking back to Tom, a 35-year-old man undergoing his annual physical, he explained that he drinks a beer or two at night. How would you gauge whether he has substance use disorder with regards to alcohol? You begin by asking Tom the cage questions. Have you ever felt the need to cut back? Are you annoyed by people being critical about your drinking? Do you ever feel guilty about your drinking? And have you ever needed a morning drink eye-opener to get through the day? Tom admits that he does feel guilty and has tried to cut back, but keeps binge drinking on the weekend with his buddies. His wife has asked him to quit, but he hasn't been motivated. You reassure Tom that there are resources to help him, and you start by asking if he's ready to quit drinking. Tom nods his head and emotionally admits that he's been thinking it's time to change his behavior, but hasn't known where to start. You give him information for a local Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. You encourage him to focus on quitting alcohol and schedule a follow-up visit in 3 months to further discuss his smoking cessation. Tom thanks you for your insight and leaves the office ready to take the first step towards sobriety. And that's our show. If you liked this episode, send us a comment or give us a thumbs up. Until next time.